Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Americans are quite familiar with American presidents coming on the air in a moment of crisis to say planes are in the air and bombs are on their way. Saturday was different. After a week of outrage over chemical attacks in Syria, President Obama appeared to lay out his argument for a strike against the Syrian regime and then hit the pause button, said he would look to Congress to approve the action. That is a major turn of events with implications at home and abroad. This hour on Point, the president goes to Congress on Syria. You can join us on air or online when this conversation is always on. Has the president made the right move here? How would you tell your congressperson to vote? Join us anytime at On Point Radio or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from Middleburg, Virginia, for a look at U.S. military forces on hold over Syria is Jim Michaels, military reporter for USA Today. Jim Michaels, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So here's the president on Saturday. Before he goes, turns to Congress, he says, I've decided that the United States should take military action against Syrian regime targets, said, I'm confident we can hold the Assad regime accountable for the use of chemical weapons. So how much is on hold? What's on hold? What's the situation with the U.S. military posture there now, Jim?
Well, Tom, this is mostly considered to be a sort of a strike primarily from the sea using cruise missiles. So what's on hold is they have five U.S. Navy destroyers, each armed with dozens of Tomahawk cruise missiles in the eastern Mediterranean, and basically they're on standby. The president said when he spoke that delaying the attack will not in any way, weaken or reduce the U.S. response. So they are able to hold out there, and that's what they're doing right now.
Jim, we heard also General Martin Dempsey, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, has told the president that with the kind of strike that they have in mind, it would be just as effective, quote, in 3 weeks as in 3 days. Some people may listen to that and wonder, how can that be? Doesn't it give the Syrian government the time to move or bury or hide or get in the bunker or you name it?
Well, yes. Yes and no. I mean, they've definitely said that, and you're right to raise a note of skepticism. We do have incredible intelligence assets that's able to track a lot of this stuff. ISR, surveillance and reconnaissance, drones, satellite imagery, and the like. So there's no question that the U.S. does have the ability to track a lot of this stuff. But the other thing, but any time you delay an attack like that, it does give the advantage to your adversary. For example, what if he starts moving this stuff into population centers to sort of use civilians as human shields? It does allow them to prepare, and it also allows Assad to sort of sow doubt internationally and so forth and within his own country. So there are some disadvantages to a delay, no question about it.
When you say move this stuff somewhere, are you talking about chemical warfare materials, chemical sarin, the Secretary of State now says was used? Is that what you're talking about?
What the military has said they're going to do, they probably will not go after the chemical stocks themselves. Syria's got VX, sarin, both nerve agents, and mustard gas, a chemical that burns the skin. If they try to bomb those stockpiles directly, it's obviously going to potentially cause a huge amount of collateral damage.
Yeah,
so you don't want to do that. What you want to do is hit the vehicles they use for, I don't mean literally vehicles, but the delivery mechanisms, the artillery, the rockets, and so forth, the units that they believe are responsible for launching this stuff. So you want to do the units and the artillery and so forth linked to the chemicals and not the chemicals themselves.
There's a lot of
yes, you can move that stuff around.
So those could be on the move. There's a lot of concern. You know, Colin Powell used to say this: "You break it, you own it." That there's no such thing as just a quick strike and you're done with it. I mean, we had Dempsey himself saying that he just doesn't believe anymore that you can do business that way. That force itself is going to really change things. So what about in this instance?
There's so many variables that can happen. A limited strike, you're right, is sort of, in many respects, a misnomer. The biggest problem, I think, right now in Syria also is that the opposition, we've said, the Pentagon has said, and others have said, is basically an unreliable ally at this point. A couple years ago, more than 2 years ago when this started, it was very much a popular revolt, still very disorganized, still a lot of disparate units, but it was very much a popular revolt. It's so much mesticized now. So you've got al-Qaeda elements in there. You've got rival groups within there. You don't have any opposition that's able to take over should Assad fall. And that's the dilemma for the administration. They want to sort of do a deterrent that prevents Assad from doing this again, but they don't want to collapse the regime and plunge that area into chaos, which would even be worse than the stalemated civil war they've got now.
Jim, in the past, we've seen the Pentagon lets politics play out in America on these strategic decisions, but there can be a kind of wink and nod. Now it's going to Congress. If there are signals from Pentagon to Congress about yay or nay, you know, whether or not to do this, what do you think the body language of the Pentagon will be to Capitol Hill?
Well, I think they're already using Pentagon folks to start to do some of these briefings and so forth. So I think they've got to walk the line very carefully. You know, they can talk about capabilities and potential outcomes and so forth, but they've obviously got to stop short of anything that would look political. So I think, you know, the military will and has been used to sort of make the case, but they have to do, they're walking a very fine line because you don't want to step across that line and look political.
Of course, the stakes couldn't be higher, and everybody's eyes will be on this now. Jim Michaels covers the military for USA Today. Jim, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Here's the president in that extraordinary speech on Saturday, extraordinary only because of a whole lot of recent American history, where he said that he knows what he wants to do. He wants to strike Syria, but he will go to Congress for approval.
Having made my decision as Commander-in-Chief based on what I am convinced is our national security interests, I'm also mindful that I'm the president of the world's oldest constitutional democracy. I've long believed that our power is rooted not just in our military might, but in our example as a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. And that's why I've made a second decision. I will seek authorization for the use of force from the American people's representatives in Congress.
President Obama on Saturday did not do that over Libya, will do it over Syria. With us now from Washington is Nancy Cordes, congressional reporter for CBS News. Nancy Cordes, welcome back to On Point. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
First, just the basics. What does it take for Congress to authorize the use of force in a case like this? What kind of vote from whom?
Well, you'll have to have a majority of the House and the Senate voting in favor of a resolution that the White House sent down to Capitol Hill shortly after the president gave that surprising speech on Saturday, asking for authorization for the use of force in Syria. Now, right off the bat, one of the things that we've heard from many members of Congress from both sides is that they feel that that resolution is too broad, that it essentially gives the president a blank check to use whatever kind of force he wants to use in Syria for as long as he wants to use it. Now, the president has said that he wants any strikes to be limited in nature, that he doesn't want to put boots on the ground, but what Congress wants the White House to do is rewrite that resolution, stating that more clearly, narrowing the focus, and then that'll help to get more people from both sides on board.
An awful lot of the talk out of Capitol Hill already, just in this day and a half, is that if the vote were today, it would not be there to back the president's call for intervention here. Is that your sense right now, Nancy?
That is my sense right now. We talked to so many members who flew back in. Some of them took red eyes to get back here to Capitol Hill. Obviously, they're on recess right now, but they came back for this classified briefing that national security advisors held yesterday. And they have a lot of concerns, and they reflect their constituents who have a lot of concerns. They want to know, what's the strategy here? How long would this intervention last? What's the goal? What's the outcome? What's the possibility that Syria could try to retaliate? What's the possibility that Iran could try to get into the game? All of the thorny questions that have prevented the U.S. from intervening before, when Syria has used chemical weapons. And so that's why the White House didn't call on Congress to come back early from its recess and take this vote now. They know that they need about a week to make their strongest case to members of Congress. And the president is doing this sales job himself. He got on the phone yesterday, called a number of members of Congress. He's bringing a parade of lawmakers, key lawmakers, to the White House Monday and Tuesday to try to change their minds.
It was a classified briefing for Congress yesterday, but did you get a sense of the message there? Was it about the sarin gas? Was it about the bigger strategic picture? If we hit Syria here, the likely implications? Did you learn anything about what was said there?
I think it was a two-pronged message. First, it was, here is all of the evidence that we have about Syria using sarin gas on its own people that we can't necessarily share with the broader public. But this is why officials are so sure that that Bashar al-Assad did gas his own people. And then the second message was, here are all the reasons that we believe that, and by we I mean the White House, what the White House believes is all the reasons that it makes sense to strike Syria now. Now, I didn't hear a single lawmaker coming out of that briefing who doesn't believe the evidence. Everyone said, you know, we believe the evidence that Syria used these chemical weapons. We have no doubt about that. They are more skeptical about the second part, about why the U.S. needs to intervene in Syria now.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the White House hitting the big pause button on hitting Syria and where the pause may take the U.S. and the Middle East. Nancy Cordes, a congressional correspondent for CBS News, is with us. Nancy, let's just get a little sound from over the weekend and today from Congress. This was Democratic Congressman Chris Van Hollen of Maryland, of course, big Democrat, saying the White House resolution as delivered to Capitol Hill so far needs a time limit on military action and some guarantees that U.S. troops will not be sent into Syria before he, a Democrat, could support it.
I believe that the draft resolution supported, presented by the administration, does not currently meet that test, that it is too broadly drafted, it is too open-ended.
And here's Republican Representative Peter King of New York yesterday on Fox News Sunday, saying if a vote were held today, he said then, the House vote would be no.
If the vote were today, it would probably be a no vote. I'm hoping by the time next week comes around, and hopefully the president can make his case, that he will be able to get a majority of the House of Representatives. Right now, it will be very difficult. And also, we have an increasing isolationist wing in our party, which I think is damaging to the party and to the nation.
Republican Peter King. Nancy Cordes, so here we are. September 9th, before they're even officially back in session, you tell us how much time they might take to debate and vote. Do you see this, you know, it wouldn't pass today kind of talk as posturing, or is this the real deal? Will they, do you think, ultimately line up behind the president, or is there a real possibility of Congress saying, no, thank you, Mr. President, and that's that?
Well, I think it is the real deal because, you know, there are a lot of members of Congress who didn't think that they were going to have a say in this debate and were kind of staying out of it. They thought the president was going to make up his mind whether to conduct these strikes. And even though they asked him for congressional authorization, asked him to come to Congress and ask for permission, they were assuming that they wouldn't get it. Congress always asks presidents to do this, and most of the time presidents ignore that request. So suddenly, over the weekend, the president does go ahead and ask Congress, and now people are kind of getting back into this debate for the first time and working through some of these very thorny issues. And there are a lot of members of Congress who were here 11 years ago and took a similar vote on the Iraq War, and they're still scarred by that. They still feel that that they were misled by some of the intelligence, and that they wish that they hadn't given the president a blank check to go to war in Iraq. And so they are calling for a much more narrow resolution this time. And the White House, which is, of course, eager to get people on board as quickly as possible, is saying that it will work with members of Congress to change that language, to make it clear it doesn't want to go to war, it doesn't want to put boots on the ground, but it wants to have the authorization to make targeted strikes as soon as Congress can vote for this.
And Nancy, just a quick look at the math before we let you go. You know, we see a lot. We've got a Republican majority in the House. We've got a Democratic majority in the Senate. Could there be a split vote here? What needs to happen in each chamber to get to yes or no?
You know, this is not an issue that necessarily falls down party lines. We've heard from Democrats who are for strikes. They say that what happened in Syria was a moral outrage and there needs to be a response. We heard from Democrats who say, you know, they don't want to get involved. And the same on the Republican side. So both sides are going to have to post big numbers in order for this to pass in the House and the Senate. Senator John McCain of Arizona, Republican, I spoke to him yesterday. He said at the end of the day, he thinks it will pass if only because it would be so harmful to the president's reputation abroad if it didn't. But tellingly, even McCain isn't ready to say right now if he's going to vote for it.
Nancy Cordes, congressional correspondent for CBS News. Nancy, it's very good of you to join us. Thanks so much for coming on.
Absolutely.
Here's just a little more of the president on Saturday in the Rose Garden.
Here's my question for every member of Congress and every member of the global community. What message will we send if a dictator can gas hundreds of children to death in plain sight and pay no price? What's the purpose of the international system that we've built if a prohibition on the use of chemical weapons that has been agreed to by the governments of 98% of the world's people and approved overwhelmingly by the Congress of the United States is not enforced?
President Obama challenging Congress to authorize a strike against Syria. And the Secretary of State, who was so outspoken about the moral obscenity of the alleged chemical gas attacks, sarin attacks, he's saying now, spoke on Meet the Press yesterday. NBC, here's Secretary of State John Kerry with host David Gregory.
I do not believe the Congress of the United States will turn its back on this moment. I think the interests that we have with respect to potential future confrontation, hopefully not, but the challenge of Iran, the challenges of the region, the challenge of standing up for and standing beside our ally Israel, helping to shore up Jordan, all of these things are very, very powerful.
Understood.
Interests.
And but if Congress says no,
will pass it.
The exhortation, the lobbying begins, kind of an extraordinary couple of weeks in front of us right here, to look at this path now, here and in the Middle East. We're joined first by Aaron David Miller, joins us from Oxford, Maine, public policy scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center. He's been involved with six U.S. Secretaries of State on Middle East policy and Arab-Israeli negotiations, big thinker on this front. Aaron David Miller, thank you very much for being with us today.
Tom, great to be here.
And with us from Washington, Paul Piller, visiting professor at the Center for Security Studies at Georgetown University, 28-year veteran of the CIA, was one of the agency's top analysts, retired in 2005, accused the Bush administration of cherry-picking evidence for going into Iraq a decade ago. Paul Piller, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hello, Tom. Good to be with you.
Aaron, let me come first to you. If you were speaking to Congress or to your congressperson, how would you urge them now to vote and why?
You know, I think the challenge basically is you have a president who essentially has, over the last 2 years, wisely and willfully, in my judgment, avoided militarizing the U.S. role in Syria. Mm-hmm. He's tried every conceivable way to stay out of a conflict in which he's persuaded, particularly in the shadow of Iraq and Afghanistan, there is no good end state, and that the application of American military power in that situation is very unclear. I think in the end, the reality is he faced a situation where, in essence, he had very little support at home, very little support abroad, and an option, the so-called limited surgical strike option, that I don't think he even believes in. And as a consequence of that fact, he, in some respects, made a virtue out of necessity. His own temperament, his own record in Congress suggests a strong inclination to work with Congress before the use of force. That was his position, of course, during the second Iraq War. And with such a weak hand, such bad options, and no support abroad, he's taken a risk that, in effect, he can create a deeper bench for himself when, in fact, he does exercise that option. Whether or not this was the right move, Tom, I think it was virtually inevitable, given the cruel realities that exist in this country today with respect to getting involved in another foreign war, and the limited options, frankly, available to the United States with respect to the Syrian crisis.
Boy, if it was inevitable, this speech in the Rose Garden on Saturday, a lot of people didn't see it coming. I mean, the talk was so fierce and appeared to be driving so directly towards some kind of strike. But still, the question remains, Aaron, how would you encourage Congress to vote on this?
You know, in the end, I believe the president has three broad options. Do nothing. Which, in my judgment, however risky a limited strike and counterproductive it may be, is right now morally unconscionable. Do everything along the lines that Senator McCain has advised, which is to essentially create a systemic, sustained military strategy to tip the battlefield balance in favor of opposition groups, the preponderance of which right now neither share our values nor our interests, or the third option, which, as Paul knows in government, is the middle option, the muddle through option. I think, Tom, that in view of what has transpired in the last 6 days in Washington, the creation essentially of a new red line in which the president and secretary of state have probably in the history of warfare, there is not a more widely telegraphed and advertised inclination to strike that in the view of this new red line, I think the president has no alternative but to exercise that middle option, however imperfect it will be. So if I were in Congress right now, Democrat or Republican, and I worked for both and I voted for both, I would probably vote to authorize a highly circumscribed resolution. I know it's imperfect, but frankly, I think the alternatives, doing nothing on one hand or doing everything on the other, are either unconscionable or reckless.
Highly circumscribed, but I thought I heard you say that a limited strike would be morally unconscionable.
No, what I said was doing nothing would be morally unconscionable.
Okay.
And I also believe this, by the way, that the whatever military option the president, if in fact Congress approves it, I think will be far more punishing and comprehensive than we have led to believe. I don't think this is just a question of trying to deter the Syrians from using weapons, chemical weapons. I think there is an element of degrading, and they have used this term, the two Ds, deter and degrade, in almost all of their public statements. I think that this strike will be designed in large part because of the limited nature of chemical weapons-related targets. I think it may well be designed to be much more punishing with respect to Syria's military infrastructure and their assets. So I reluctantly endorse this option, because I think to not to carry it through right now will basically mean hanging a close for the season sign on whatever influence the United States, this president, is going to exercise in this region for the remainder of his term. I would be a reluctant warrior here, though. I say that knowing full well the contradictions inherent in my own remarks.
In that, you seem to be in the president's corner, reluctant warrior indeed. I want to come back to this issue of exactly what will be authorized, because even the language that the White House is sending to Capitol Hill seems fairly circumscribed to me, but you say they should or will do something broader, while Congress is looking at maybe reining it in further. We'll look at that. Paul Pillar, I want to come to you, and really the same question. How would you encourage Congress to vote here, and why?
I would encourage a no vote, and the fundamental reason is no one has explained how U.S. interests are at stake in someone else's sectarian civil war in which both sides are dominated by elements that represent values that are anathema to what we stand for. The dominant forces on the opposition side are radical Islamists, many of the al-Qaeda ilk, that we've been doing battle with now for over a decade. By the way, I agree very much with Aaron's analysis of how the administration got to where we are now. The one thing I would add to it by way of background is several months ago when this chemical weapons issue first came up, the president evidently being under a lot of pressure at that time to get involved in a conflict that he clearly does not want to get involved in, found evidently as a convenient way to deflect that pressure, to say, in effect, well, I'm not doing anything right now beyond the indirect aid to the opposition that was decided on. But if they use chemical weapons, then that's a red line. That's a game changer. Mm-hmm. And I'm afraid, you know, that has kind of boomeranged on him now because we hear people, of course, making the argument that credibility is at stake of the U.S., of his own making, and so on. But as to whether it's conscionable or not to not do anything, I would point out that in this civil war, we've had, by most estimates, about 100,000 people killed. What happened in this reported CW incident some 11 days ago, well, you've heard the official U.S. estimated figures. Some people
1,400, they're saying.
Yeah, come up. Anyway, we're talking about on the order of, you know, a hundredth or so of the the overall fatalities in this war. And that begs the question of why, or raises the question of why this particular use of this particular weapon should engage us in to the extent of military intervention when we haven't done something like that.
Two questions there. One, Senator Kerry calls this a moral obscenity. We've got a century of international opposition to the use of chemical weapons. What about that? And B, can you step past the credibility, the leverage question so lightly? The President of the United States did say that this kind of attack, this kind of use, would be a red line if he now says, never mind, even behind a no vote from Congress. What's the message there to Iran or others in the region? Is that a problem, Paul?
On the first question, I mean, 2 points. One, there are moral obscenities all over the place on both sides of this civil war. And with regard to chemical weapons in particular, I would note the U.S. position has hardly been consistent on this. The last big use of chemical weapons was by Saddam Hussein during the Iran-Iraq war, during a period in which we, the United States, were tilting in favor of Iraq and against Iran, and we basically turned a blind eye to that. So I think the message that many people, especially in that part of the world, will take out of this kind of action is not that this was a blow in favor of
Moral
rectitude or maintaining a norm of non-use of CW. Instead, it will be an instance of the U.S. bashing a regime it doesn't happen to like.
And U.S. credibility, leverage?
On the credibility issue, that is simply not the way other governments assess our credibility or indeed the way we assess the credibility of others. If there is some future situation in which we would like others to believe that we are serious about doing something, whether it's military intervention or what have you, are those other governments going to say, well, my, back several years ago, there was this earlier instance in which a U.S. president said something, and then after further weighing U.S. Interest, they decided not to attack? Or are they going to look at whatever that future specific situation is and what the U.S. interests are at stake in that situation, and the pros and cons that the U.S. decision makers of that day will be facing? I would submit it's the latter and not the former.
So you don't think there's a parallel here? Iran watching this says, you know, they have their alleged nuclear program. Well, you know, there's chemical use in Syria and no response in the U.S. So pedal to the metal on nukes.
Well, actually, as far as the Iranian nuclear side is concerned, I would argue it works the other way. The more that the U.S. is using the military cudgel in that part of the world, the more that stokes interest in Tehran in developing a nuclear weapon as a deterrent.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the White House hitting the big pause button on hitting Syria and where the pause may take the U.S. and the Middle East. The president saying he wants Congress to vote on authorizing strike on Syria. He says he, as commander-in-chief, wants to do it. He wants congressional backing before he does it. Aaron David Miller joins us from Oxford, Maine, public policy scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center and longtime advisor to half a dozen U.S. administrations on Mideast policy. Paul Pillar is with us, longtime top CIA analyst in this region. He's now a visiting professor at Georgetown University. Here was John McCain yesterday, Arizona Republican senator, saying that Syria's president, Bashar Assad, must be thrilled by President Obama's choice to go to Congress for approval before acting.
Bashar and his people are euphoric. The Iranians are happy. When the president of the United States said that he was going, that it was a red line, he didn't say that it's a red line and, by the way, I'm going to have to seek the approval of Congress. He said it was a red line and the United States of America would act. And that is a big difference, and that's one of the reasons why this is so problematic.
Of course, presidents can't win here. If they act without approval, they get all kinds of heat. If they go for approval, there's another kind of heat. In Cairo yesterday, the Arab League foreign ministers meeting to discuss Syria. They ultimately urged some kind of action here. Here, for a sense of the region, or at least one big player, Saudi Foreign Minister Saud al-Faisal said the international community needs to take action against the Assad regime.
Along with the Syrian people, we demand the international community to take all necessary measures to help them and stop the hooliganism of the murderers. We support them, and we will not be satisfied by just condemning the situation. We demand the full support of the international community to stop the attacks on the Syrian people before they perish.
The Saudi foreign minister, of course, essentially calling there on the United States. NATO saying today it's not going to be involved here, though its chief said that a strong reaction is needed to show dictators around the world that weapons like this cannot be used with impunity. But it wouldn't be NATO's job to do it. On Meet the Press yesterday, NBC Republican Kentucky Senator Rand Paul said that he believes U.S. involvement in Syria would be a mistake. Here's this kind of a no-thank-you wing of the Republican Party.
You know, people say, well, 100,000 people have died. We must act. Well, if our weapons get involved and we get involved, do you think more people will die or less people? But I think the war may escalate out of control. And then we have to ask ourselves, who is on America's side over there? If the rebels win, will they be American allies? Assad's definitely not an American ally, but I'm not convinced anybody on the Islamic side, the Islamic rebels, will be American allies.
Not clear what this vote is going to be. Aaron David Miller, Paul Pillar, stand by. Lots of callers waiting. Troy in Iowa City, Iowa. Troy, you're on the air.
Oh, thanks, Tom.
Yeah.
Why doesn't Saudi Arabia send troops or Kuwait? Shouldn't the Arabs take care of their own problem? You know, the leader is killing its own people. Why doesn't the Arabs step up and be a man and take control over the situation? Why does it take an outside power like the United States?
Troy, thanks for that. Aaron David Miller, there's the Saudi foreign minister in a full high dudgeon saying there needs to be action. Troy says, why don't they do it?
You know, there's so many anomalies and contradictions that characterize this entire affair. You know, you've got Arab sensitivity to American intervention, colonialism, stretching back, you know, well over a century.
Yep.
Conspiracy theories about intervention. And at the same time, you have this cri de coeur on the part of the Arabs to basically, I tend to agree with the caller's sentiment. The question is practically whether or not you want the Arabs, even though they are quite competent, and in the case of the Saudis, you know, equipped with sophisticated American military technology, you know, going after very sensitive targets involving chemical weapons. I suspect the answer to that is probably no. The Saudis provide their, you know, quiet, discreet support in terms of money and weapons to their favorite rebel and opposition groups.
But so just materially, you'd rather not have them do it.
I don't think so. And I think by and large, there's a degree of hypocrisy that characterizes almost everybody's position on this issue, including the Saudis.
Yeah. Let's go to Beth in Schenectady, New York. Beth, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Oh, wow. Hi. This was a comment. My grandmother, who passed away, was one of the Rose of the Riveters. She made top-secret precision Norton bomb sites.
Ones,
you know, they were, yeah?
Back in World War II days, in the factory, yep.
Yeah, but she made the bomb sites.
Yes, I got it. We got it.
Okay. were supposed to be precision, accurate, pinpoint accurate, and they ended up being decommissioned because, of course, they weren't. So one of your, they were the ones used on the Enola Gay. One of your guests says these are going to be precision strikes. They always say that. And what happens if more civilians are killed than what were killed in the gas? How are you going to answer that?
Beth, it's a good question. Paul, what do you say to Beth's concern? I mean, we have laser-guided and all the rest now, and still we know what happens. And with this time lag, some of their targets, as you or Aaron said, could be moved into population centers.
It's a valid concern. The movement of targets is one concern. Inaccurate information is another. We can recall what we did to the Chinese embassy in Belgrade during some earlier interventions in the Balkans that are often cited as a precedent. And as my friend Dick Betts at Columbia says, anyone who talks about a surgical strike should seek a second opinion. There are a host of reasons, operational, intelligence, and just the fog of war that lead to a high potential for collateral damage, for escalation, and things getting out of control, even if we have the most precise bomb sites on the planet.
Aaron, if I heard you right, I think you're not arguing just for some precision strikes, or maybe you were, but you want more than just something symbolic. You say deter and degrade are the words you're focused on. How big, how wide do you imagine it could be if there's sign-off?
I mean, I'm not arguing for a surgical. I mean, I'm accepting, in my judgment, the inevitability that if, in fact, Congress authorizes, the president is going to strike. I'm also assuming it is the least undesirable of the options at his disposal. What I'm suggesting is that we've all been led to believe that this set of targets is going to be narrowly focused. And I guess what I'm suggesting, limited and narrowly focused in comparison to what? I mean, limited and narrowly focused perhaps in comparison to both our efforts in Iraqi 1.0 and Iraqi 2.0 to deploy and mobilize forces and to strike. But that doesn't mean that the administration will be confined to a small set of targets. I'm focused on this issue of degrading because on the issue of deterrence, who knows? A regime faced with an existential struggle for survival will in fact deploy chemical weapons repeatedly again if it has to. So the issue is degrading, and does the administration have a more ambitious set of targets in order to do that? I think the answer is probably yes. I do not believe this is going to be a bunch of cruise missiles launched into an empty warehouse somewhere.
How ambitious, then? I mean, we saw David Sanger's piece over the weekend in the New York Times. He quotes Chris Hill, Mr. Obama's first ambassador to Iraq, saying a lot of people, including some in the administration, think that the chemical warfare argument is an excuse to get Assad himself to, you know, decapitate the regime.
Would they go after leadership targets in an initial strike, or command and control, or military intelligence, or those around President Assad if they could identify him? Would anybody care if, in fact, they succeeded in really care if they succeeded in eliminating part of the Syrian leadership? I mean, I think the answer is people would probably be thrilled. That's not going to fundamentally tip the battlefield balance in Syria, because you have residual Alawi elements that will continue to struggle on and fight on, and you're going to have all kinds of score settling in terms of this Sunni Alawi rift that has opened up.
Well, some people might care. I mean, Rand Paul might care. He might not, explicitly might not want to get that involved in the civil war. I mean, decapitate the regime or go after major degrading of Assad's forces, and are you not then in the civil war?
I think that would, in fact, create a not just the perception, reality, that we have become a combatant. Again, all I'm suggesting is if and when the administration does strike, I believe that this is going to be far more expansive and far more punishing than we have been led to believe.
Paul, how far can the U.S. go in the scale of a strike without sort of initiating the Colin Powell, you break it, you own it dynamic?
Well, you heard earlier in the hour from Jim Michaels the fine line that the military planners and policymakers are having to walk here, are trying to walk, in being enough to send a message, supposedly because of these reasons related to deterrence with use of chemical weapons, but not getting fully involved in a full-scale civil war. And I agree with most of what Aaron has just said about how the dynamics of this work, and in particular, as he noted, Assad and his regime, if they see it necessary or desirable to use more chemical weapons in the future, they will. And then what happens to deterrence? Then what happens to sending a message? We would look even worse, and the situation of the norm against use of CW would be even in worse shape than it was before if we don't get even more deeply involved at that point.
I mean, Aaron, won't the language that goes to Congress matter a lot on this front? Or do you think they'll just, if they can get a yes vote, they'll do what they like? Because the current language, as I'm reading the way it's presented here, is action to prevent or deter the use or proliferation of chemical biological weapons.
Right.
That doesn't sound like a general, green light to degrade regime forces.
No, but, you know, if you can't go after the actual stocks, although I suspect the military has weapons that can, in fact, be used to destroy chemical weapons stocks, and there's always the danger of dispersal of these agents, of course, then you go after the delivery systems. And the delivery systems and the associated infrastructure could be quite expansive in terms of, you know, these target sets. That could include artillery, include aircraft, include command and control, it could include those units that are associated with deploying chemical weapons. So, it's not being too clever by half. It's just a certain reality. Paul is absolutely right. If, in fact, they do this, they're going to try to seek that balance to discharge the president's obligations to maintain these international norms, to send a powerful message that there must be a cost. There must be some cost. I mean, war, sadly, is a permanent reality in the human enterprise. And the real question is whether or not it's so contradictory, hypocritical, to adopt the argument that there are some agents used in war that are, I guess, not acceptable, even though 100,000 Syrians have died, most of whom not as a consequence of chemical weapons. Is there no point at which there is any sense of responsibility on anybody's part to impose a cost for the use of weapons? You know, the Israelis have reacted clearly on the gas issue. I heard an interview a while back, again, invoking Holocaust imagery. Holocaust metaphors with respect to the use of gas. I mean, is there no norm that needs to be enforced to make war a little less barbarous and cruel? I know it sounds ridiculous and hypocritical, but in a way, it really is the last vestige on which the administration is hanging an argument for intervention. This is not a president. Look, this president is focused on the middle class, not on the Middle East. He knows the U.S. is stuck in an angry, broken, and dysfunctional region that he can't fix and he can't leave. He's just trying, desperately trying, I think, to find some middle ground that isn't so encumbering, but yet upholds a measure of American credibility. I know it's not perfect.
Eugene in Canton, Ohio. Eugene, you're on the air.
Hello. How convenient of our, if it prospers America, we're against it, President Obama. Finally, he wants to talk to the Republicans. He wants to delegate his red line to the Republicans so he can blame the devastation that will happen because of this if things go wrong with his Muslim Brotherhood. You know, George Bush had the weapons of mass destruction. It looks like they did end up in Syria. But our president wants to... John McCain, they should talk to Sarah Palin. John McCain is siding up with the president. Don't understand why, because the Republicans will end up getting the blame for whatever goes wrong. with Obama and his Muslim Brotherhood.
Eugene, we've got it. I mean, he's clearly looking to share responsibility for this decision. On the other hand, Congress has called, including the Republicans, has called for the president to share that responsibility. But your point taken, it does spread it around. Paul, what about the possibility of retaliation here? We've got moral absolutes, we've got strategic dictates and considerations here, but just practically speaking, what about Syria or Syria and Iran retaliating after an American strike? Is there real capacity there?
I don't expect we're going to see immediate retaliation. What the Assad regime will do will depend on the course of the civil war. His side appeared to have the upper hand in the couple of months, you know, leading up to these most recent events. If it looks like, especially if we're seeing the kind of degrading that Aaron is talking about, if a military strike does occur, that the overall tide goes against him, then I think in addition to using probably more chemicals inside Syria and perhaps even additional lethal non-chemical methods, then the prospect of trying to spread the war, strike out, especially striking against Israel, because that would allow them to play more fervently the propaganda point that they're standing up, you know, not just for the power of the regime, but, protecting Arabs against Israelis, that sort of thing. Then the prospects for spread and escalation become considerable. As far as the Iranians are concerned, we're hearing kind of a mixed message from Iranian leaders. They have their own experience with poison gas back during the Iran-Iraq war, and so they have mixed feelings about it.
Regional escalation, nobody welcomes that, Aaron David Miller.
They don't. Although the region actually has a kind of set of insurance policies and safety valves, which tend to avoid the kind of worst Armageddon-like scenarios. Middle East wars don't happen by coincidence either. I suspect the Iranians and the Syrians will over time look for a way to respond, but not draw in the very thing they want to avoid, which is an even more robust American military response, let alone adding the voice and the power of the Israelis to this already combustible mix.
Aaron David Miller, Paul Pillar, this debate will go on for a week or two here. We'll follow. Thank you for being with us today. This is On Point.